The temperature climbed startlingly that day. The noontime was balmy. The Germans brought soup and bread in two-wheeled carts which were pulled by Russians. The Englishmen sent over real coffee and sugar and marmalade and cigarettes and cigars, and the doors of the theater were left open so the warmth could get in. The Americans began to feel much better. They were able to hold their food, and then it was time to go to Dresden. The Americans marched fairly stylishly out of the British compound. Billy Pilgrim again led the parade. He had silver boots now, and a muff, and a piece of azure curtain, which he wore like a toga. Billy still had a beard. So did poor old Edgar Derby, who was beside him. Derby was imagining letters to home, his lips working tremulously. "Dear Margaret, we are leaving for Dresden today. Don't worry. It will never be bombed. It is an open city. There was an election at noon, and guess what?" And so on. They came to the prison railroad yard again. They had arrived on only two cars. They would depart far more comfortably on four. They saw the dead hobo again. He was frozen stiff in the weeds beside the track. He was in a fetal position, trying, even in death, to nestle like a spoon with others. There were no others now. He was nestling with thin air and cinders. Somebody had taken his boots. His bare feet were blue and ivory. It was all right, somehow, his being dead. So it goes. The trip to Dresden was a lark. It took only 2 hours. Shriveled little bellies were full. Sunlight and mild air came in through the ventilators. There were plenty of smokes from the Englishmen. The Americans arrived in Dresden at 5 in the afternoon. The boxcar doors were opened, and the doorways framed the loveliest city that most of the Americans had ever seen. The skyline was intricate and voluptuous and enchanted and absurd. It looked like a Sunday school picture of heaven to Billy Pilgrim. Somebody behind him in the boxcar said, "Oz." That was I. That was me. The only other city I'd ever seen was Indianapolis, Indiana. Every other big city in Germany had been bombed and burned ferociously. Dresden had not suffered so much as a cracked window pane. Sirens went off every day, screamed like hell, and people went down into cellars and listened to radios there. The planes were always bound for someplace else. Leipzig, Chemnitz, Plauen. Places like that. So it goes. Steam radiators still whistled cheerily in Dresden. Streetcars clanged. Telephones rang and were answered. Lights went on and off when switches were clicked. There were theaters and restaurants. There was a zoo. The principal enterprises of the city were medicine and food processing and the making of cigarettes. People were going home from work now in the late afternoon. They were tired. 8 Dresdeners crossed the steel spaghetti of the railroad yard. They were wearing new uniforms. They had been sworn into the army the day before. They were boys and men past middle age and 2 veterans who'd been shot to pieces in Russia. Their assignment was to guard 100 American prisoners of war who would work as contract labor. A grandfather and his grandson were in the squad. The grandfather was an architect. The 8 were grim as they approached the boxcars containing their wards. They knew what sick and foolish soldiers they themselves appeared to be. One of them actually had an artificial leg and carried not only a loaded rifle, but a cane. Still, they were expected to earn obedience and respect from tall, cocky, murderous American infantrymen who had just come from all the killing at the front. And then they saw bearded Billy Pilgrim in his blue toga and silver shoes, with his hands in a muff. He looked at least 60 years old. Next to Billy was little Paul Lazaro with a broken arm. He was fizzing with rabies. Next to Lazaro was the poor old high school teacher, Edgar Derby, mournfully pregnant with patriotism and middle age and imaginary wisdom, and so on. The eight ridiculous Dresdeners ascertained that these 100 ridiculous creatures really were American fighting men fresh from the front. They smiled, and then they laughed. Their terror evaporated. There was nothing to be afraid of. Here were more crippled human beings, more fools like themselves. Here was light opera. So out of the gate of the railroad yard and into the streets of Dresden marched the light opera. Billy Pilgrim was the star. He led the parade. Thousands of people were on the sidewalks going home from work. They were watery and putty-colored, having eaten mostly potatoes during the past 2 years. They had expected no blessings beyond the mildness of the day. Suddenly, here was fun. Billy did not meet many of the eyes that found him so entertaining. He was enchanted by the architecture of the city. Mary Amoretti wove garlands above windows. Roguish fawns and naked nymphs peeked down at Billy from festooned cornices. Stone monkeys frisked among scrolls and seashells and bamboo. Billy, with his memories of the future, knew that the city would be smashed to smithereens and then burned in about 30 more days. He knew, too, that most of the people watching him would soon be dead. So it goes. And Billy worked his hands in his muff as he marched. His fingertips working there in the hot darkness of the muff wanted to know what the two lumps in the lining of the little impresario's coat were. The fingertips got inside the lining. They palpated the lumps, the pea-shaped thing and the horseshoe-shaped thing. The parade had to halt by a busy corner. The traffic light was red. There at the corner, in the front rank of pedestrians, was a surgeon who had been operating all day. He was a civilian, but his posture was military. He had served in 2 world wars. The sight of Billy offended him, especially after he learned from the guards that Billy was an American. It seemed to him that Billy was in abominable taste. Suppose that Billy had gone to a lot of silly trouble to costume himself just so. The surgeon spoke English, and he said to Billy, "I take it you find war a very comical thing." Billy looked at him vaguely. Billy had lost track momentarily of where he was or how he had gotten there. He had no idea that people thought he was clowning. It was fate, of course, which had costumed him. Fate and a feeble will to survive. "Did you expect us to laugh?" the surgeon asked him. The surgeon was demanding some sort of satisfaction. Billy was mystified. Billy wanted to be friendly, to help, if he could, but his resources were meager. His fingers now held the 2 objects from the lining of his coat. Billy decided to show the surgeon what they were. "You thought we would enjoy being mocked," the surgeon said, "and do you feel proud to represent America as you do?" Billy withdrew a hand from his muff, held it under the surgeon's nose. On his palm rested a 2-carat diamond and a partial denture. The denture was an obscene little artifact, silver and pearl and tangerine. Billy smiled. The parade pranced, staggered, and reeled to the gate of the Dresden slaughterhouse, and then it went inside. The slaughterhouse wasn't a busy place anymore. Almost all the hoofed animals in Germany had been killed and eaten and excreted by human beings, mostly soldiers. So it goes. The Americans were taken to the 5th building inside the gate. It was a 1-story cement block cube with sliding doors in front and back. It had been built as a shelter for pigs about to be butchered. Now it was going to serve as a home away from home for 100 American prisoners of war. There were bunks in there, and 2 pot-bellied stoves and a water tap. Behind it was the latrine, which was a 1-rail fence with buckets under it. There was a big number over the door of the building. The number was 5. Before the Americans could go inside, their only English-speaking guard told them to memorize their simple address in case they got lost in the big city. Their address was this: Schlachthof 5. Schlachthof meant slaughterhouse. 5 was good old 5.